This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 237 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Happy spring, Max.
Yes. Wow, it feels like it too. The flowers are starting to come up already, so always a good sign.
Yeah, so March came in like a lion. It's going out with like a lamb, and I'm okay with that. I'm ready for some spring. It was nice to be able to pop the roof this morning, today of the truck, just to drive around and get some fresh air in my lungs.
Wonderful.
But we got a lot of stories tonight. I was a little overzealous on cherry picking stories, but there was a lot of good news this week. We're going to talk Lockheed Martin and Skunk Works, UTM testing, nuclear power plant inspection, pizza delivery by drones, a lot of near misses and a possible not near miss in New Zealand, Canadian drone regulations, and demolition drone derbies. Well, our first story comes from AIN Online. Skunk Works reveals stealthy UAV demonstrator, the X-44A. UAV was on static display for the public for the first time over the weekend. This is a missing link in the clandestine universe of Lockheed Martin drones, ending up with the RQ-170.
Because this goes back quite a ways, doesn't it, David?
It does. It first flew in 2001. So you're talking 17 years that this aircraft has been classified.
It's a nice looking thing. Flying wing design, carbon fiber with a 30-foot wingspan. I guess, David, they used this to kind of test out some concepts early on in the Lockheed unmanned development programs.
Yeah, this was a Skunk Works project, which is the Lockheed development division that handles dark and black projects. It was designed to simulate the shape, the 30-degree wing sweep of what would become a couple of the other hybrid drones that Lockheed has done. It really was a scale model. So it was propelled by an F-112 turbojet, which is a cruise missile, and it had a fixed tricycle landing gear. So really, they were testing the wing shape. It didn't need to have a bomb bay or wingspan or anything like that. But it was designed to give them experience in flying wings, which Lockheed didn't have at the time.
But now we see that Lockheed is continuing down this development path, and they've revealed something else new, a concept anyway.
Well, Lockheed's finally let the people see what the MQ-25 tanker looks like. This is the Navy's, what used to be C-class, which is now been converted to a more limited aerial refueling aircraft, called the MQ-25 Stingray. So the three current competitors are Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, and General Atomics. And they are competing for the ability to build four prototype aircraft. So this aircraft will be an autonomous tanker to relieve F-18s and other aircraft from the carrier so that can do air-to-air refueling, as well as a limited attack. And ironically, it looks very similar to the X-44, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, at least in these artist drawings that we've been seeing lately. It's an interesting mission, right? So it's designed to leave from a carrier, fly, some 500 miles or so, carrying its fuel load, then refuel the fighters, and then fly back to the carrier. Kind of an interesting concept that you'd use a flying wing for a tanker. But I guess Lockheed, anyway, believes that it's a pretty efficient way to carry that kind of a fuel load.
We know that flying wings are very efficient for carrying large payloads. Lots of fuel is a large payload. When we talk air-to-air refueling, though, this is a naval aircraft, so you're using probe and drogue. You're not using a boom like the Air Force would. So you have that simpler version, and basically, with the probe and drogue, the onus is on the pilot flying the aircraft to be refueled, to control the fuel, so plugging into the aircraft. So the drone is going to fly in orbit, and then the other aircraft will fly up into it, into its drogue, and then take fuel that way. So you're not needing to have a boom operator or anything like that. So it is a simpler operation. And one of the reasons why it's so important is most strike aircraft from a carrier take fuel almost upon takeoff, because they very rarely launch with the full fuel load because they want a full weapons load off of the aircraft carrier. So the moment you take off, if you're flying a long strike mission, is you hit the tanker. So in this case, currently the Navy uses Super Hornets, F-18Es or F-18Fs. And inevitably, they have to give up one of those for each squadron. So you lose an aircraft for the strike mission. In this case, it would be a designated tanker aircraft. So we'll see where this is going. We'll look forward to a little bit later in the year when Pentagon awards the contract for the four prototypes. Hmm. And once we have four prototypes, they're going to have to use unmanned traffic control management. And with that, we go to our GPS world story. NASA completes third phase of UAS airspace testing.
Right. This was a test, a week-long test that was conducted in Nevada. The Nevada Institute for Autonomous Systems, as well as some of the partners of NASA, part of their UTM, their unmanned traffic management partners. And together they've conducted this the third phase of the overall test regime. There's a quote: the research areas of emphasis during this test included UAS ground control interfacing to locally manage operations, communication, navigation, surveillance, human factors, data exchange, network solutions, and beyond visual line of sight architecture.
And part of that was the mapping and sensor radar technology was used for this. This was done by the UAS Service Suppliers Network, which is something we talked about when I was in Baltimore, about these companies coming online to be UAS traffic management system people. And they worked with NASA Ames to develop the technology so that all of these companies are coming together to form a standardization for air traffic management systems. So they will be doing the management while the FAA handles the larger aircraft. And part of this was starting to interact between normal air traffic controls and drone management.
One thing, David, that I don't think we've talked about too much is the development program is progressing through a series of four levels, technology capability levels, or TCL. And the first and second have been completed. The first was field testing operations for things like agriculture, firefighting, infrastructure monitoring, a lot of geofencing issues, and some others. Those were concluded in 2015. And then TCL-2, which was completed late 2016, that focused on beyond visual line of sight operations in sparsely populated areas. And then this testing that we've got here is TCL-3, which again focused on testing some technologies that maintain safe spacing between both cooperative or responsive UAVs and non-cooperative or non-responsive UAVs. And this all over moderately populated areas. And then the fourth TCL, or technology capability level, to come is going to look at UAS operations in urban areas, high density areas.
And drone delivery. It'll also test technologies to large scale contingencies. And I guess basically the way they've been running this, it's been pretty much a year for spacing. So they probably will finish up doing the data analysis from TCL3 this year, and then probably early next year they'll start TCL4, if not sooner. So I think, Max, we're looking forward to continuous progression. NASA seems to be doing this incrementally, but with fairly really good results and fairly quickly. What do you think?
Yeah, and it's also kind of dawned on me lately that this UAS traffic management approach is different than what we've seen historically. I mean, if you look at air traffic management, it's, you could call it centralized, where you got air traffic control knows what aircraft are out there, and they provide direction as to where to fly, the routes to take. But that doesn't really scale very well. When you're talking about possibly hundreds of thousands of unmanned vehicles of various sorts in the airspace, that centralized approach doesn't work. So what NASA is trying to facilitate here, I think, is a different approach, kind of a decentralized approach where operators, where unmanned aircraft are aware of what's around them and direct themselves rather than getting direction from a centralized source like air traffic control. It kind of turns the whole thing on its head, but I think it's necessary given the volume of unmanned aircraft that we're talking about in the future.
And also, Max, keep in mind that all of this technology is focused to 0 to 400 feet.
Right, yes.
Which is below, really, the air traffic, the national airspace, air traffic control systems, except near airports. So we're dealing with a whole different airspace. And the FAA and the Navy and NASA, as well as these other industries, they want to be able to manage the system, but they don't want to have to interact completely with air traffic controls because they want them to focus on large airplanes with people in them,
right,
as well as the larger airspace. So if we can simplify the airspace from 0 to 400, we'll, and self-maintain it and manage it, that takes the burden off of the FAA and air traffic control. So lots of things going on, and this is a really neat aspect of UAVs that, again, we probably would have never thought we would be talking about so much, but it's quite interesting. So you have a typhoon in March of 2011. Hard to believe that that's 7 years ago. And the typhoon damaged the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. And it basically had a nuclear meltdown. Well, let's hear it for University of Pennsylvania, because this is from thebigfuture.com. Small U.S.-built drones are searching the damaged Fukushima nuclear power plant. They need to go in and look at the deterioration stuff, and what's the best way to do it? Send in the drones.
Yeah, this is obviously a very dangerous environment for humans, whether they're wearing protection or not. And they need to perform inspections. They need to measure the radiation levels, and sending in a autonomous robotic craft like a drone makes a lot of sense, but you have to do a few things first to make sure that it'll work. So University of Pennsylvania, their GRASP laboratory, the General Robotics Automation Sensing and Perception Laboratory, they're working in conjunction with Southwest Research Institute. And what they've done is they've created a sort of a model that they can use to test out the drone and the control concepts, because they need something that's autonomous, something that can navigate inside the reactors, inside the containment vessels, and also something that's not negatively impacted by the radiation. So you've got to make sure that stuff all is covered before you can actually conduct these inspections.
I was thinking about the radiation acting as a interference, electromagnetic interference. So how do you fly a drone in all that radiation? So of course there's a video to go with it, not our video of the week, but there are some videos to watch them do this, as well as we'll have a link to the press release from Southwest Research Institute. And they had a quote from that, which is, Tokyo Electric Power Company Holdings Incorporated, TEPCO Holdings, contracted SWRI to explore the use of UAS or drones within the containment. Working with General Robotics Automation and Sensing Perception, GRASP Lab at the University of Pennsylvania School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, SWRI engineers are helping adapt small drones to autonomously operate within the containment. So this will be interesting to continue to watch. It's one of those really not surprising roles that for a UAV, which is to put it in a place that a man shouldn't go. I wonder what kind of bath they give these drones after they come out and what they do to harden them for all of the radiation. So the next one, your delivery, you probably don't want radiation with, which is Home Box Office or HBO used pizza delivery drones to promote their new season of Silicon Valley. This was from adweek.com. I was really sort of surprised. Every so often we get stories, Max, from magazines and websites that you go, really? They're talking about drones? But in this case, it was Adweek.
Yeah, and this was a promotional activity from HBO. And the idea was that fans of this television series, Silicon Valley, could tweet a certain code and order a free pizza. Now, in two cities, in Los Angeles and San Francisco, drone dudes would deliver the pizza via drone to you. Now, they were limited to a maximum of 20 pizzas in each city, so this wasn't a huge volume thing.
It was a lottery for anybody who tweeted.
Is that what it was? Okay, because how exciting would it be to be, you know, the first on your block to have a pizza delivered by drone? There's a story you could tell your friends.
And it would be interesting to see how the pizza arrived. I still haven't quite figured out how the pizza doesn't get chilled flying from, you know.
Good point.
Unless, of course, there's electric-powered bags that Domino's used to have. Hmm. But so this was kind of cool. It was an interesting promotion, people getting their pizzas delivered via tweet. And the plot is in Silicon Valley, evidently, one of the main characters bankrupts a pizza company by trying to do pizza delivery by drone. So maybe Max and I need to, I'm not going to purchase HBO for a year just so I can watch one television show about drones. But maybe if somebody is a fan of the show, they can tell us all about it. So it's hard to believe, but you know, over six months ago, I was in Toronto, Canada, talking about drones and Canadian regulations, and it looks like Air Transport Canada is locking down some things that they talked about in November.
Yeah, I guess they previously released some draft regulations for comments, and I think they received a number of them, and now we're looking forward to another round of draft regulations, according to this article, sometime in the summer of 2018, this year. But there are some concerns out there, particularly with respect to, I guess, David, minimum separation distances.
I wouldn't call them draconian, but I do remember that this was a big topic of discussion, that minimum separation distances to airports, grass strips, and helipads would restrict recreational use. They were being really strict on the amount of kilometers away from airports or metropolises. So basically, someone who wanted to fly their Phantom in metropolitan Toronto couldn't do it because they were never within the minute. They were never beyond the minimum radius to an airport or a helipad or built-up areas. So I know that that was a big concern when I was up at the convention in Canada. So hopefully, and they were going to revisit those regulations.
Another issue that's mentioned in this article is aircraft compliance. And there's apparently some conversation about what happens when an operator, let's say, modifies their drone from what was shipped by the factory, or even builds their own drone, and how that affects whether the drone is compliant or not. This is kind of a tough one for me. Having to designate a drone as being compliant, or having it certified as being compliant, that really introduces a lot of complexities.
It does. And one of the things was, Say you go out and buy your DJI Phantom 3 and finally they update the regulations and really the compliant vehicle is the Phantom 4. Does that mean you get to retroactive the Phantom 3, or does that they have to do things to bring it compliant, or basically has Air Transport Canada basically killed your Phantom 3, even though that at the, when you bought it, it was compliant, but now it's not? And especially then, how do you define compliance if you're building your own drone?
Right.
You know, it's we talk about standardization a lot. And in fact, next week we should have Underwriters Laboratories on to talk about drones and standardization. So that'll be a little preview of coming attractions. But yeah, I agree, Max. It's kind of it and the distances involved with being able to fly were two challenges that Canada was coming up with. And it was sort of surprising. Draconian was the term that I was using, that we thought Canada was fairly liberal and the United States was fairly, and we suddenly did a flip where Canada's being ultra conservative and we're being more liberal here in the States. So if any of our Canadian listeners want to join in, send us some feedback at feedback@theUAVDigest.com. Okay, our least favorite subject, but we need to talk about it because it's always important, are your grounded files. In this case, we've got two stories from New Zealand. The first one was a New Zealand 777-200ER, misses a drone on final. This was from WeTalkUAV.com, and this was a 777-200 that came within a drone came within 5 meters of approaching the aircraft on final approach.
Yeah, it was coming in from Tokyo, landing at Auckland, 278 passengers and crew. And this was at a critical phase of the landing where they say that if they had, well, they would not have been able to take evasive action if they had needed to. And boy, 5 meters, that's pretty close.
Yeah, 15 feet to a 777, and a 777 is not a little airplane. And basically, it shut down the airport after the aircraft landed for 30 minutes while they tried to investigate what was going on. And this was the second event in a month. Earlier in the month, a rogue drone forced shutdown of the runways also at Auckland. So somebody's flying drones and they darn well know better. And I hope the New Zealand law enforcement gets them. And they can face up to $5,000 New Zealand under the current CAA regulations for New Zealand. But it's more because they're really starting to bristle at this.
Yeah, there's a quote from the Air New Zealand Chief Operations Integrity and Standards Officer, David Morgan. He made the position pretty clear when he said the time has now come for tougher deterrence for reckless drone use around airports to safeguard travelers, including imposing prison terms in the case of life-threatening incidents. So this spokesman for Air New Zealand, anyway, has made it pretty clear that they'd like to see some really, really tougher deterrence for this kind of activity.
And since we're talking life-threatening events, Max, we need breaking news music. Today, as we record this, which is March 29th, News Talk New Zealand, veteran TV journalist says drone may have hit his plane before crash. Basically, a light sport aircraft crashed with its pilot because of a drone. In this case, it was a serious accident. The pictures in it are showing the aircraft flipped over completely. So the aircraft the pilot was flying flew into the drone and exploded the windscreen. And basically, he had to try to land the aircraft without any forward visibility.
Yeah, and the pilot says that the force of the wind blowing through the windscreen, or where the windscreen was so great that it blew his headset right off into the back of the plane. So he had no communications while this was going on. And the photo of, I assume that's the pilot, shows that he's got a lot of cuts on the face and around the head. So I think you're right. I think this is kind of the worst nightmare of a pilot.
This is preliminary. We'll have to follow up on, see what comes of this. But this is probably the most serious accident we've seen. Now, keep in mind that also a very large bird could have done the same damage that this was. But the most possible explanation, according to the pilot, is it was a UAV or a drone.
Yeah, we'll definitely want to see the investigation on this one.
But it is kind of important. You know, we want to bring this stuff up because if you see something, say something, because it's really important. You know, and when we set up these show notes, it didn't seem like this was a good idea. But I like this idea, but it's different. We've talked about drone racing before. This was from dronelife.com. You've never seen a drone race like this before. Pro Aerial League's Full Contact Championship. Drone Demolition Derby.
Well, the Pro Aerial League recently held its season championship events, and they had spectators. They had more than 800 live spectators at the event, and they say more than 45,000 spectators online, which is great. Now, we've talked about before how drone racing can be really difficult for spectators. I mean, in most cases, with these drone racing leagues, the drones are small, they fly really fast. Some different things have been tried, running them at night with lights, or in the dusk anyway, with lights. But still, it's kind of difficult for spectators. So Pro Aerial League is trying to address that. And they've got a different idea for how they might operate drone racing.
Yeah, they have a team of six pilots plus a captain, and they rotate team roles, pilots, pit crew, and runners who handle pit stops and crashes. So you've got sort of a Formula One kind of thing. There's four 20-minute quarters of nonstop racing for one drone, and it's a small 200 feet by 85 feet course. So it's much quicker turnaround, and people can see it more, and the team rotation adds to the spectator sport, and as well as the collisions and crashes because of the speed. So interesting new way to handle racing. So definitely tell us what you think about that. You know, it's kind of reminds me of good old, okay. And I'm the young man on the show, and I'm dating myself, control line dogfighting.
Oh yeah. 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 Well, I'm all for trying different ideas that can increase the popularity of drone racing and make it a better experience for spectators and all that. Maybe this is an answer. Maybe there are some others, but I just like the idea that, you know, some of these leagues are trying some different things to see what really resonates with the population out there, the general population that might become interested in drone racing as a result of how enjoyable it is to spectate. So that's good for the Pro Aerial League.
So we do have a quick video of the week this week. This is by Haley Keene. I was at work. I needed stress relief, so I went and looked for waterfalls and drones. And this was the top 10 waterfalls of Iceland, shot by a Phantom 2 and a GoPro Hero 3. So it's pretty self-explanatory. It's just nice, relaxing waterfalls and beautiful scenery in Iceland. It's very mellow, but for a middle of the workday, take some time and look at it. What'd you think, Max?
I really like this video. These are some amazing waterfalls. I mean, I was talking to Drone Mama about this earlier today. We've both seen a lot of waterfalls in our day, but a lot of these are just spectacular. The terrain, the size, the scope, the amount of water. I mean, just everything imaginable. It's really, really beautiful. I'm about to go buy a ticket to Iceland just based on this one video. So, yeah, highly recommend it.
Yay. I did good this week.
Yeah. Oh, I love this video.
All right, Max, we got some feedback from Brett at Ag Eagle. And what did he have to say?
Yeah, there was an announcement this week. Ag Eagle Aerial Systems, which of course is an aerial drone imagery collection and analysis company, well, they announced that they closed their merger with Energex Resources Incorporated. Now, under this, Ag Eagle becomes a wholly owned subsidiary of Energex Resources, but Energex is going to be renamed Ag Eagle Aerial Systems. And what we have as a result of all this is that the stock is actually now traded at the New York Stock Exchange. And while this is this is not investment advice, and we're not telling you to invest in this particular stock, but if you're interested in looking into it or interested in just following it, the ticker symbol, they got a good one, David, UAVS, UAVs.
I love this ticker symbol. It was like really cool. I was sort of like, yeah, that's awesome. Back in the day when we traded stocks, penny stocks, etc. But so good for them. Congratulations, Ag Eagle.
We want to thank all of you for listening to episode 237 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at the UAVDigest.com. And if you'd like to go straight to the show notes, where you can see the links to all the news stories we talked about, links to some of the companies that we talked about, well, you can do that by visiting the UAVDigest.com/237.
And of course, you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, Facebook, Facebook.com/UAV Digest. Become part of our Slack listener team by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. And we'd love for you to leave us some feedback when you're on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. Let us know you're out there. And I guess with that, we will see you next week. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening. What made this one serious is it's the worst fear, Max, of all of our pirate friends. It's the worst fear of all of our, it's the worst. Okay, you're going to need to put that in the bloopers.